It is 8:32. We have with us live in the studios once again, John Parrish and Maria Tomczyk, both with Eat the Steak. Good morning.
Good morning.
Good morning to you.
All right. Plenty to cover, starting with local and developments this week at Nicholsville.
Yeah. Monday, about 4 a.m., homeless advocates from really all sectors of the Seattle activist community came together and erected Nicholsville, which is a tent city intended to be an impermanent encampment reminiscent of the Hoobervilles, designed to highlight both the city's lack of shelter beds for the homeless and the Nichols administration policy essentially of making war on the homeless through their illegal sweeps and of encampments and various other harsh measures. That drew an immediate response from the city, saying they had 3 days to vacate. The deadline came and went Thursday evening, and Friday midday yesterday, the police moved in. This was down at West Marginal Way in West Seattle, and 24 people were arrested, according to the organizers, although they were immediately released once they were taken in for processing. And the encampment itself basically regrouped and continues. There's some adjacent state land that the encampment is now on that they don't expect to stay on for very long. They expect eventually the bureaucracy will wind its way through and the state will respond, and besides which the city is really the target here, and the opinion of the general public also is a very, very visible location for commuters on Marginal Way where the site is now. And they've gotten several offers from supporters during the course of the week incidentally, the site that it's currently on, it turns out the organizers didn't know this. They found out a day into the encampment, is actually intended by the city for construction of a jail. So there's a certain amount of irony in that.
excuse me.
And there was a community meeting Tuesday night in which the neighbors said they'd rather have the permanent homeless encampment there than a jail.
Yeah.
They've gotten a number of offers from supporters over the course of the week for potential permanent sites for Nicholsville. So it is not going away, and it's really a win-win for the organizers. Either you have, on the one hand, the city does not crack down on it, in which case you've got both actual safe, patrolled, community-oriented permanent place for the homeless people to stay in this city, because unlike what the Nichols administration has been claiming this week, there are not shelter beds available, and many of the shelter beds that the city does make available on an ongoing basis, not only are they always full, but they're really not conditions that you would want to be in. Either you have the possibility of a permanent encampment that offers the homeless a dignified place to stay and live, or you have the Nichols administration highlighting what its policy toward encampments has been all along over the past year, which is in contravention of the city's own regulations and in contravention of its own rhetoric and promises, having unacceptably cruel and inhuman and illegal policies toward the homeless, seizing their possessions, not giving any warning before sweeping in and ringing the encampments, and really not doing anything other than hoping that the homeless will somehow go away. That this is a city that simply does not want to have poor people within its borders. And this has been made very clear on any number of fronts by the Nichols administration.
And it comes at a time when there's an increasing number of homeless people.
Yeah, and obviously with the economic downturn, which we'll talk a great deal about in a minute, the problem is going to get worse rather than better, and the city needs to be making plans and preparations, such as opening more shelter beds, making more plans for transitional housing, taking the 10-year plan to end homelessness seriously rather than as a rhetorical device to give cover to politicians. All of these things need to be happening, and they're not happening under the Greg Nichols administration. And this is what Nicholsville is about, and it's going to continue, and the organizers have been very grateful for what really has been a phenomenal outpouring of support over the past week.
Yeah, and I thought one of the great things that the organizers did was they did outreach to the local community and the local community representatives. And the local community is more of a blue-collar one. It's not like on Magnolia, for example, where if they were to set up a Nicholsville there, they would probably expect local members of the community to call the police immediately. The local community organizers said, well, yeah, you know, the city wants to build a jail here. You know, how many of these people have been criminalized just for being homeless and would end up in that jail anyway? So we think, why don't you house these people and you may eliminate the need for building a jail here. So it was interesting to see that the local community organization had come out and said, it's not that we support these people, but they are our neighbors, and we are willing to have them here for however long it takes for the city to get the message and to change its policies.
Yeah. Unlike the tent city encampments of the past, this is intended to be, it's modeled on Dignity Village in Portland, which is now a permanent site and has been a great boon to the homeless in the city of Portland. The idea is to get a permanent encampment that can be the start of a safe place that homeless people can go until such time as they have city provided housing. And you know, it's something that the Nichols administration simply has not been interested in, but this issue is not going to go away. And so we're looking at a permanent encampment reminiscent of the Great Depression.
All right. Moving on to this week's economic news.
Speaking
of the Great Depression and speaking of housing, the whole housing crisis has bubbled up to become a banking crisis. And now we've got the federal government talking about a bailout. The question, of course, on everybody's mind this week is a bailout really needed? Some folks say yes, and those who are in particular connected to the banking industry say, yes, 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 bail us out, please. And that includes the Fed chairman, Ben Bernanke, who comes right out of the banking industry with his work experience, and the Treasury Secretary, Henry Paulson, who came from Goldman Sachs. These guys would love to see a bailout of the banking industry.
Particularly Paulson will be back in the banking industry in another 3 or 4 months.
Oh, yeah, as soon as Bush is out of office. So, yeah, these guys would love to see a bailout of the banking industry that would help them and their friends. But a week has passed now, and the rest of us have been looking at the economy, and really the sky hasn't fallen. The credit markets have not collapsed. The economy itself has not come crashing down. And some things are a little bit clearer now a week after the crisis first, you know, hit. What we're seeing now is that banks that have failed or are on the verge of failing, that includes Washington Mutual and Wachovia, which is under talks to maybe be bought out sometime in the next week or two. These banks are ones that are in trouble for a reason. It's not because they have managed their assets wisely or that they have a lot of depositors. It's because they have made risky loans and they've done things that they shouldn't have been doing. And when Washington Mutual failed, sure, a lot of people were unhappy the first day. And now a day or two later, we're starting to see that, well, now that the dust is clearing a little bit, it's maybe not a bad thing necessarily. Sure, shareholders lost everything. Well, you could argue that shareholders who got enormous profits off of their Washington Mutual stock while it was making all these risky investments probably should have known that there was something, that there was a large amount of risk attached to that, those high profits. And when you take that kind of risk, you got to expect the possibility of a failure and that you're going to lose the complete value of your holding. So I don't have a lot of sympathy for shareholders who are saying, please do the bailout so that you can save our investments in these big banks. Wachovia, which is in some trouble because its stock price is falling precipitously, is in trouble because Wachovia made big bets on mortgage-backed securities, and they issued a lot of risky mortgages as well. So, you know, they're in trouble for a reason. What we're seeing now, too, is that the money market funds that were in trouble last week were in trouble not because they were money market funds and because the economy was on the verge of collapse and the credit markets were on the verge of collapse. They were in trouble because those those money market funds catered particularly to big institutional investors like these big banks who needed the cash right away, and because these money market funds made extremely risky investments by violating their own investment, their own safe investment policies, and loading up on huge amounts of risky debt.
So let me be clear about this. What you're saying then is that the free market is working.
What I'm saying is that the guys who got us into this kind of problem, who are having the most trouble, the banks that are having the most trouble are the ones who should pay for the crisis that they've caused. At this point, giving a bailout to the top guys at the top of the pyramid is only going to encourage more risky behavior. So if you pour money in at the top to try to free up credit so that credit will be cheap again and they can loan out the same way they were loaning out 2 years ago, you're going to just compound the problem and make it worse. It's just basically putting off the collapse and perhaps making the eventual collapse even worse. And what we're seeing right now is with Washington Mutual depositors and Washington Mutual, people who have mortgages through Washington Mutual, et cetera, nothing's really changed. Nothing has really changed for them. What's changed is the situation for Washington Mutual executives and Washington Mutual shareholders. And a good argument can be made for the fact that they're the ones who should be taking the brunt of the problem. And we shouldn't be jumping in to bail them out. And I also want to say, too, that there's a big argument being made that, well, credit markets froze last week, therefore we need to inject money into the system at the top to keep the credit markets going and to keep money available at cheap interest rates. And there's definitely an argument to be made that, no, you don't want to do that, that, in fact, credit markets didn't actually freeze, that many companies were still able to borrow money last week. It was just these big banks that were in trouble that were having problems borrowing. Also, there's an argument being made to support the bailout that says, well, homeowners are having trouble borrowing money to refinance and home buyers are having trouble borrowing money to buy properties, particularly properties that, you know, the price has fallen and we need to get the market going again to prop up the prices, et cetera. Well, no, there's an equally compelling argument to be made that, well, no, things are just settling back to the way they should have been, which is in order to get a mortgage loan, you needed to have a down payment and you needed to have a good credit history. Those kind of folks can still get a mortgage in this environment, in this climate, pre-bailout. And I would argue, and I think a lot of people would argue, that's the way it should be. You know, you shouldn't be making credit available to anybody who wants it, regardless of their personal finances. You shouldn't make it so easy for people who have already borrowed too much to borrow more, because that is just going to compound the problem. So, and there's an argument to be made that if we go through with the bailout, that is what would happen. That, okay, you take people who already borrowed too much and allow them to refinance and borrow more. Or, what you would be doing is be allowing more people to jump into the housing market, and that would, people who don't have a down payment and don't have good credit, and you'd be increasing your pool of buyers, and therefore prices on housing would go back up to unsustainable levels. And that's not necessarily a good thing. So the question, of course, is after making these arguments making the argument for and the argument against, and you can see who would benefit from a bailout would be these big banks and businesses as well, who, you know, another argument made for the bailout is we have to free up credit and make more money available so that businesses that borrow money for their day-to-day operations can still get loans cheaply and quickly. And that's becoming a problem. That's really, I think, what they refer to when they say credit markets have seized up, that businesses in other industries are having trouble borrowing money for their day-to-day operations. And there's an equally compelling argument to be made that, well, businesses who have to borrow money for their day-to-day operations are not being operated in a responsible manner, and that those that don't have decent cash savings or don't have the income stream to fund their day-to-day operations and then only borrow in order to make capital purchases, those businesses who can't follow that model should be allowed to fail. So that's a very compelling argument to be made. Now that
Maria
we see...
Maria Tomczyk, the economic Dr. Aura.
Right. So now that we see who would benefit from a bailout, basically banks that have made risky investments, the shareholders that own stock in those companies, and the businesses that have been hooked on debt and doing the same thing that people who borrowed too much to buy houses that were too expensive for them, some businesses have done the same thing. Those are the folks who would benefit from a bailout. Who would not benefit? Well, taxpayers definitely would not benefit. And the reason why, I just want to describe what that bailout would look like. The actual mechanism for buying these mortgage-backed securities, basically, it would be through an auction. The way an auction typically works is someone has something to sell. There's a multitude of people who want to buy, and the seller sets a price at which they want the bidding to start, and then whoever bids the highest price gets to buy the item, right? In the auction that the Treasury Department and the Fed are talking about, what would happen is you would have a multitude of sellers and one buyer. And the one buyer is the federal government. And what the federal government would do is they would say, okay, we would set a high price for these securities, not the low bargain basement price at which they're valued right now, but we would set a relatively high price, and we would see how many sellers want to sell at that price. And then we would set the point a little bit, we'd set the price a little bit lower and see how many sellers still want to sell at that price, et cetera, until we get the number of securities we want to buy, and then we buy at that price. Well, to me, that sounds like you're allowing the sellers to set the price. And whenever a seller is allowed to set the price and the buyer has no idea what they're buying, that's a situation rife for abuse. And it means you could be, for example, buying a whole bunch of securities at $5 a pop from a whole bunch of different banks, and you could end up with a lot of stuff that's really worth about 5 cents each.
Not to mention in that scenario that the seller sets the price knowing how much the buyer intends to buy.
Yeah, knowing how many of the security the buyer intends to buy. So it's rife for manipulation and abuse. In addition, banks know exactly what they're selling. We assume that banks know what kind of stuff they'd be selling, but the federal government would have no idea until the securities are bought and paid for and they've held them for a while. They wouldn't know whether they got junk or good stuff. And in addition, a question that nobody is asking that has to be asked is, what is the federal government going to do with homes that go through the foreclosure process? Right now, banks, which have these mortgage lenders who have some experience handling foreclosures, are having a hard time keeping up. And there are plenty of houses sitting vacant and deteriorating because banks can't keep up with the high number of foreclosures. What is the federal government going to do? And do taxpayers want to take on that burden and that expense of keeping up homes that are going through the foreclosure process? So that's a question that's not being asked that needs to be asked. So what we really need to do is we need to ask, what would the economy look like if we didn't go through this bailout? And one of the big scary scenarios that the Fed and the Treasury keep saying is, oh, look, we could look like Japan after they went through their economic recession. I just want to ask Job, because he's been to Japan recently. What does Japan look like right now, Job?
Very prosperous. Why do you ask?
Because
the trains all run. They have public transit. They have very good infrastructure. People have a pretty good quality of life.
People have a high savings rate.
People have a high savings rate. There's a lot of jobs. And they
good
actually
health.
Oh, the healthcare, system is excellent. And people don't have to worry about it because it's of course like every other westernized country except ours.
Yeah,
it's taken care of by the federal government.
Yeah, so rather than bailing out their failing companies in the 80s when when their recession hit, the federal government put money towards more important things.
It's actually the early and even mid-90s.
Yeah.
It was more recent than that.
Yeah, and we can look to Europe, too, who is going through a similar banking crisis, and the crisis in the European Union, and European governments have said, no, we're not going to bail out our banking industry. And have to say that Europe is no third-world country. You know, I mean, it is possible to say no to these kinds of things.
And in fact, not only is Europe not a third world country, but it is the preferred investment destination for international investors at this point.
At this point.
Because they manage their economy much more responsibly than the United States has.
Yeah. And in addition, this bailout would not be managing the economy. It is government intervention in the worst kind of way. There are different ways to do it. You can do it after the fact, which is what we're doing right now, or you can do government intervention when it's most important to do it, which is before the problem occurs, and that would be government intervention in the form of regulations, which have been largely removed from the financial industry in this country. We need to reintroduce those regulations. I also want to point out very quickly that the bailout could affect U.S. credit rating, the U.S. government's own credit rating. And this is an important point because the U.S. government has made it a policy to press other governments around the world to not bail out their own companies and their own banking industries, et cetera, when they've hit crises. And that happened in 1997 when the Asian financial crisis hit. The U.S. pressed Asian governments to not bail out companies, and Asian governments complied. They didn't bail out companies. They went through a period of pain, and they have recovered. And now they're watching what's going on here in the U.S., and they're saying, hey, we hold the vast majority of U.S. government debt, you know, is held by Asian investors and Asian banks and Asian governments. And they're saying, what the heck are they doing? They're bailing out companies. Does that mean that U.S. government debt is not a good buy? You know, and if you have foreign investors who hold the vast majority of U.S. government debt saying, we don't think it's a good deal, then you're really talking about potential economic problems here in this country. So what do...
And the loss of valuation of the dollar, too. That's
right,
also tied into all this.
That's a very big problem. And so what do we need to do? People have been calling in massive numbers their representatives, particularly Nancy Pelosi and Harry Reid, the Democrats and the Democratic leaders of the House and the Senate, to say no bailout plan. And I just want to emphasize that if those calls drop off, then the Democratic leaders will think, oh, people are becoming resigned to the idea of a bailout. They're going to try to work out a plan in the next 2 days. And I just want to emphasize, if you have called them in the past to say no bailout, call them again today and call them again tomorrow and keep calling. And if you haven't called them yet and you think they shouldn't do a bailout, call them. Definitely. To let them know, because now is the time and you won't get another chance to tell them what you think.
Operators are standing by. All right. Anything else on that?
No, let's move on.
All right, let's jump to international and developments this week in Pakistan.
Yeah, amidst all the hand-wringing that was going on over the economic crisis, some really very important things were happening in Pakistan this week. First was early this week when there was a bombing that killed several dozen people at the downtown Marriott in Pakistan. This is significant for several reasons. One, it was pushed back by the militants and probably in the northwest part of the country for recent attacks against them, both by U.S. forces and by Pakistani forces, demonstrating for the first time that they can really strike at any time they want, anywhere that they want, even into the heart of the establishment of Pakistan. Secondly, the significance of the target, the Marriott Hotel in Islamabad, is really the place where foreign diplomats, ambassadors, trade delegations, foreign business leaders, and so forth stay and hang out and meet. It's well known for this throughout Pakistani society. That building is now destroyed and several dozen people dead. This is a real crisis of legitimacy for the new Pakistani government. At the same time, you had that government essentially at war with the United States this week. On Wednesday, a U.S. drone crossed the border into Pakistan, crashed. The Pakistani government claims that the army and civilians in the area shot it down. The United States is saying, no, it crashed. Not that the United States Army would ever lie about things like this. And The following day, you had shots exchanged between a U.S. Patrol, Army patrol that Pakistan said crossed the border, and Pakistani Army installments at the border, who would be in a position to know where the border was. So this is something that the two governments are trying to defuse, but those orders are still there by the Pakistani government to shoot upon entry. And we saw last night in the presidential debates, Barack Obama had many good things to say, but one of the more troubling things that he had to say was, and John McCain, I suspect, would behave no differently, was, yeah, we're going to go into Pakistan. This is setting us up for a very serious escalation of the war on terror that that nobody's really talking about, whether it's appropriate or not. So this is very, very much something to keep our eye on.
All right. Then that moves us to this week's events.
Oh, well, let's see. We have several things going on this week. Of course, this weekend, of course, is Sustainable Ballard. Also tonight, the Washington Physicians for Social Responsibility annual dinner at 6:30 with the keynote speaker, former Attorney General Ramsey Clark. That will be at the Jerry Brockie Center at the South Seattle Community College in South Seattle. On Friday this week, Naomi Wolf will take a break from not giving fashion tips to Al Gore to go speak at Town Hall. She'll be in town promoting her latest book. And tomorrow night, Eat the State is having its anniversary party and wrap up for its fundraising drive. It'll be at 7 o'clock at Nodder Number Books, 1945 North 45th Street, rather, in the heart of beautiful downtown Wallingford. Jim Page, among other musical guests, will be entertaining and will be mixing and mingling and trying to squeeze you for money and celebrating 12 years of existence of Eat the State, which is a community-based newspaper that is all volunteer-run, that has always been run on a shoestring, always been very dependent on reader and listener support, and we're in debt, and we're trying to fix that through our summer fund drive, which is coming to an end. We're still a little short of our goal, and so could really use your donations and really use your help. So stop on by tomorrow night, bring your checkbook, bring your ears for some musical entertainment, and meet the folks from Meet the State, and have a good time. Again, 7 o'clock, Not a Number Books. By the way, we want to thank Not a Number because they'll also be offering 10% of all their proceeds from what they sell tomorrow night, the books and gifts and cards and all the other things that they have will be donated directly to the state. So we don't normally say this, but go buy stuff. that's 7 o'clock, Not a Number Books, 1945 North 45th in Wallingford. Be there or, well, just be there.
All right. Talking as we do every week with John Parrish and Maria Tomczyk, both with Eat the State. And in addition to Not a Number of Books, where do people find Eat the State?
You can, by the way, there will be T-shirts at Not a Number of Books also if you want to get your stylish Eat the State T-shirt. The papers are available wherever you find free newspapers, at bookstores, cafes, King County Library System, so on and so forth. Or you can find it on the web, and we do have a PayPal donation button there also for folks who can't get to Wallingford tomorrow night. www.eatthestate.org, and if you have, there's an excellent article that begins this issue, by the way, by Maria, summarizing the current economic crisis. So I want to encourage people to check that out either in print or on the web. And if you have questions, comments, tips, feedback on anything you hear on this show, feel free to email us at info@eatthestate.org.